Good evening. I think I mentioned last time that I had the last Dharma talk how every time we do that chant, I appreciate it in another from another angle. And tonight, we rarely encounter it. The name of this talk would be There is a Path, which is the third noble truth. And usually, actually, we don't really focus on this noble truth, there is a path. But it came to mind the other day, Sadhu and I were talking, and I noticed she has this also on her website now, on her weekly newsletter, about how even people who practice may not really have appreciated the truth, the significance of the third noble truth, which is there is a path. So tonight I want to talk about the significance of this, of this third noble truth. So the first noble truth is that there is suffering, that all our daily round is marked by suffering, anguish, dissatisfaction, restlessness, always a little bit of dis-ease in our usual states of mind. The second is the source of that is desire and clinging. And the third is there is a way to end that, to bring an end to that. It's called cessation. So this is what we want to, and then the fourth, of course, is the Noble Eightfold Path. So what is cessation? What is it that we're cessing? that this refers to? And we all have ample examples of that. So we'll draw on some of that tonight also. So struggle colors and suffuses all of life, not only human life, but all forms of animal life and plant life, except that struggle is a matter of sentiency. And so what is the sentiency of a plant? Plants are definitely reactive to their physical conditions, including Mozart. You know, I don't know if you're familiar with the study that was done in orange groves in Florida. This was a number of years ago, and they started by playing some raucous jazz, like what's his name? Well, Pharoah Sanders would be one, and they didn't do so well, and the flowers were not. What do you call it when flowers are, bees go to flowers and germinate and all of that. So there was less of that. The next season, they played Mozart, and there was massive flowering, and they produced much more and much bigger and much juicier fruits. So Mozart, remember that, when in need. But even those of us who practice can bypass the meaning of the third noble truth, the significance of the teaching that there is a path. And what does that mean in our own lives? The struggle that subsumes all of us because we don't actually believe that there's a path. It may be a path for other people, but not for me, right? Or there may be a path, it's hearsay, but I myself don't get it. Or I remember so often in the early days of my own practice being around people who said there's a path and it takes many lifetimes to realize it, which was very well discouraging but separating from the deeper way of living, the more wholehearted way of living. So if we don't really know the significance of this truth, we get really swallowed up by conditions without any kind of rescue. And we forget that there's a refuge and what the refuge consists of. We don't really understand how to get from hearing the word, the words, to being actually freed from the suffering. of our life. And what does that freedom point to? What is the liberation? What is the liberation and what is the root, our own personal root in our own ordinary life in Corvallis, Oregon, on this eve of 2020? What is the route to liberation? How will that appear? So it's the third noble truth. So first of all, I want to talk about noble. The dictionary meaning of noble is having excellent moral character, showing greatness and magnanimity. This is the moral. So when we talk about the noble truth, talking about the truth that allows us to live with excellent character, with greatness, magnanimity, greatness of heart, and generosity, and sweep of activity. So Dogen talks about magnanimity. He says the magnanimous mind is not a biased or contentious mind. So-called great mind is in its spirit like a great mountain or a great sea. It has no partiality and no factionalism. Lifting an ounce, it does not consider it light. Lifting a stone, it does not consider it heavy. This is really very profound teaching. And it is the meaning of being on the path. Having accepted this path. I sometimes think of having accepted Jesus into our hearts. It's the same thing. It's just different language and different imagery. But it's this sense of wholeness of spirit and the ability to meet our life circumstances when they come in whatever forms they come. Magnanimous mind, or big mind, as Dogen says, is like a mountain, stable and impartial. Exemplifying the ocean, it's tolerant and views everything from the broadest perspective. So when we ask the question, how do we meet the current social and political situation? We can say, okay, what is the broadest perspective that I can hold? With magnanimous mind, we engage in activity with impartiality. We're not swayed by our judgments of good and bad. That's an interesting statement. We are not swayed by our judgments of good or bad, because we all make these judgments. They have a certain truth, good and bad, in regard to one particular perspective. But if we're going to meet our life with a magnanimous heart, our perspective needs to be cultivated in its broadest way, which means really applying the attention to what are all the aspects, or what goes beyond my immediate and habitual way of approaching this. What else can I see? What's beyond the blinder there, if I take the blinders off. Magnanimous mind makes all things equally sacred and valuable. Most, especially those things that we tend to discredit or devalue. And so, there is a way. The way looks at everything for what its place. Everything is in its right place. So how does everything function, including all the difficulties? How can we allow them to function fully? Dogen offers the tenzo advice, that's the advice to the cook, in practicing with magnanimous mind. He says, your attitude towards things should not be contingent upon their quality. He says this in several different places there. Put those things that naturally go on a high place onto a high place, and those that would be most stable on a low place onto a low place. Clean the chopsticks, ladles, and all other utensils. Handle them with equal care and awareness. putting everything back where it naturally belongs. Keep your mind on your work and do not throw things around carelessly. Really, really, this is a teaching that comes to my mind all the time. And especially with thoughts, don't throw things around. Don't throw opinions around carelessly. Don't throw fearful thoughts around carelessly. Don't throw prideful thoughts around carelessly. I mean, recognize what they are. Treat them with care. So on this path, we practice noblesse oblige. I love that phrase, noblesse oblige. Especially when little kids are taught it and they say it, it's really cute. I'm practicing noblesse oblige, which is honest, benevolent, and honorable behavior, which is considered to be the responsibility of people of high birth. Right? And we on the path are on the noble path. And we really have a responsibility to treat all of life with care. It is up to us. So now that we've looked into what noble is referring to, when the Buddha uses it, let's look at the third noble truth and how it points us always to being our most developed self. To aspire to that, to remember that that's a possibility when we get the right conditions. And the conditions are partially up to us through practice. So the third truth in how we live our everyday life, that's the only place that it's useful, the third noble truth. So when we've seen into the significance of this, we've seen into this phrase, all of life is subject to arising and ceasing. All the things that make up our life arise, have a certain duration, and go away. This is a very profound insight, and it's also lies right at the basis of all of suffering, that which resists the truth of impermanence. When the Buddha gave his first teaching to his five companions, so you know that story when he finally awoke, and he decided not to, that this insight into life just as it is so infinitely profound and minutely subtle that nobody would understand it. And then Brahma comes and says, teach it. Those with a little bit of dust in their eyes can see it. And most of us, that's true, much of the time. And we can see this, the truth of this. So his first five companions, who he traveled with and practiced with for 6 years before he finally decided to go his own way, they arrive. And the only one, when he gave his first teaching, which is the sutra on setting the wheel of Dharma in motion, only Kondana, only one of the original disciples, understood the significance of the third noble truth. There is a path. There's a difference between understanding the meaning and realizing the significance of this. Of course, there is a path in ordinary terms. Yeah, that's right. Here we are. But what it means for traveling between our suffering self and the self that is liberated, there's no distance between. Really appreciating the significance of there is a path. Looking around at all the suffering in the world, it does not have to be this way. It is a path. And yet, hundreds and thousands of millions of ages, we may not see it. And there are billions of people who do not see this path. So the ending of suffering comes with the ending of clinging. The ending of clinging comes with seeing and recognizing clinging. Recognizing impermanence. Seeing how holding on, you know, whenever you're suffering, the surest step on the path is to think, what is it? What is it that I'm holding on to here? And it can be a variety of things. You can hold on to an idea about who you should be, what you should have, how you should behave, should. This life shouldn't change, I shouldn't age. So on the one hand, we all do that, I think. I do it. But then there's also the liberated view, which is, yes, everything changes. And there's a certain kind of ease and equanimity that immediately arises when we open to that truth. And we open to it only through reflecting on our experience. So we experience, I mean, that's what we do in Zazen. We sit here and we just reflect on our experience. I was just reading a terrific article. Does anybody here get The Sun? There's an article in there on how to meditate by a guy who has been meditating for 45 years. And every single little thing I was saying, yes. But he says, he started meditating with the group Ananda Marga. Did anybody ever hear of Ananda Marga? That was a big one years ago. And they taught 3 minutes of meditation twice a day. Wow. And so he goes through and talks about 3 minutes of meditation. And that's all you need. That's all you need to remember. Now, I don't know. I think most of us need more than that initially. But the remembering, the coming back to, is actually, that's a description of what we do when we live a life of practice. Is something comes up in our life, and for a minute we remember, oh yeah, whatever arises goes away. You know, 3 minutes, 2 minutes, 30 seconds. Dissolving the suffering, dissolving the resistance, recognizing the true nature of everything in our life. And we can't believe it. We can't believe this teaching. We have to recognize its truth in our own experience through contemplating and pondering it. So that's one reason why I wanted to bring it up in a talk, is to encourage everybody to really actively work with this. There is a way. And I love that. I love that phrase. So during the day, something will come along and you'll be resisting, fighting against it, and then you'll say, oh no, there is a way. And then immediately you're restored to your larger perspective. It's not transcending this life. That's not what's meant. But it's not only having our immediate reactive experience, but also having the larger Buddha view. The Dharma eye is open to the nature of the Dharma. All phenomena. So we invite an attitude of willingness to be receptive, pondering, and considering. We're always receptive, open. All things are empty, all things are open. The mind can be quite open. We can tighten around and resist, and then open and relieve. So this mental state is very important and is the way out of our suffering. Holding on to fixed views and prejudices and thinking that the mind knows it all, or else just taking what other people say as being the truth, is what we call ordinary mind. The mind of the way is open and can reflect upon something that we can see within our own minds. So we become aware of our own minds as the filter through which everything we experience comes, is past. Working with our own mind, we change the filter. We have, you know, the filter on your heating ducts, if you have forced air. It's really, You get that hose out and you really clear it out. It's the same thing with Zazen. You're just hosing down the filter. And we do that whenever we reflect on our own experience with curiosity, rather than with fixity and grabbing. So this Dharma is rarely encountered, even in hundreds of thousands of millions of ages, because it takes a special kind of willingness in order to ponder and investigate and get beyond the gross and the obvious and the habitual. It takes a willingness to actually look at our own reactions, to be able to see the attachments and to contemplate, what does this attachment feel like? So what am I attached to? This is a really, it's a very practical and straightforward practice, actually. Whenever there's suffering, what am I attached to here? So what are some of the things that you're attached to? Now, this isn't the mind of right and wrong, good and bad. I'm not advocating that. But just taking a look at, with a neutral attitude, what are some of the things that you're attached to, that come up for you in your own suffering states?
Friends? Friends?
Friends. So sometimes those cause suffering. You don't want to lose friends. Yeah.
Security and certainty.
Certainty and security. Yes, indeed. It's a big one.
Comfort. Physical comfort.
Physical comfort. One more.
Esteem.
Esteem. Yeah. Self-esteem.
Or others holding me in esteem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which can have its source, it can be a real source of anxiety. Or it can be a really wholesome motivation. Depending on circumstances, right? Yeah, so whatever we're holding on to. So as you go through the day tomorrow, you know, what are the attachments there? So do you know all of the experiences of desire that lead you around? So there is a way, and this is part of the way, is to really get familiar with that which we are attached to that lead us around. You know, I think of this being held in high esteem by people and how that is connected with the experience of shame, which many people suffer terribly from. And their lives are narrowed tremendously by the fear of having an experience of shame. So it closes down our willingness to really show up. The sense of safety, it's not safe to show up. So through knowing desire as it is in all of its forms, without judging the beauty or ugliness of it, we come to see desire as it is. And there's the knowing of the nature of it, how it feels in the body, what it says in the mind, how it constricts or opens our energies. And by laying aside these desires rather than grasping at them, we experience nirodha, the cessation of suffering. By laying aside these desires. Now, we can take this on in a lot of different ways. One of the things that caused the Buddha to finally just stop all of his deprivation practices and just sit there and watch his mind was he took this denial of desire way, way to the extreme until he almost died because he hadn't eaten anything. I think he was eating one grain of rice a day or something like that. No kind of nutrition. And that's also a denial of the real situation. So we contemplate cessation of desire by seeing through the very experience of desire in its, with its many faces, just knowing it for what it is. So there is a way, and the way of allowing things to arise and pass away in their own time and manner. The way things are, to know directly the nature of our own experience, to see it in its unfolding being and passing away, its birth, life, and death, is the meaning of the Buddha Way. This is a matter of life and death. And it's the liberating factor, liberating us from our delusion that something is fixed and it's real beyond, it's permanent. So liberation from a fixed view. Sometimes we are mistaken and think that liberation means we are liberated from conditions. And we can't be liberated from conditions. Conditions are the stuff of a life. But we don't have to misunderstand the nature of the conditions and think that they are something fixed. This is what's called entering the mountain, or entering the ocean of vast loveliness, free from the constraints of a worried mind. That's a short and easy sentence, free from the constraints of a worried mind, but so challenging. A worried mind sees only separation, sees only in one way. So I'm emphasizing tonight the importance of reflecting on there is a way to help you remember to bring it forward when you're struggling. Rather than just developing a method of tranquilizing your mind, which is certainly one part of practice, but a full life of practice is a commitment to wise investigation. It's not just a tranquilized mind. It involves a courageous effort to look deeply into things, not just analyzing yourself and making judgments about why you suffer on a personal level, but fully experiencing your life as it is, in all of its complexity and struggle, grief, change, holding on, knowing it for what it is, with a warm and undefended heart. Resolving to really follow the path until you have profound understanding that includes all of your life, so that you are always on the path, and everything is always part of the path. Such perfect understanding is based on a pattern of arising and ceasing. This is the law. The Dharma is the law, right? It's often referred to as the law of how things are. Everything fits into this pattern of arising and ceasing. So I'd like to finish with a couple of, or three very, very short poetic statements. One is by Gary Snyder. This present moment that lives on to become long ago. That's spoken by an old man. It's not something that earlier we think about too much. New Year's Eve, one fixed day in a world of change. Coming right up. And then Nakagawa Soen Roshi, vast emptiness. As the year comes to a close, I re-enter the mountain. Whenever we sit for meditation, we re-enter the mountain. Whenever we recall practice in the midst, we re-enter the mountain. It's why when we practice a practice of 3 minute zazen, we're re-entering the mountain, we're remembering the call of the birds and the smell of the breeze. They're the primal, primary, direct, momentary experience, which is our path, whether we like it or not. Thank you.